Hey everyone, this is Tom Salami of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. I've got a great conversation with Boston Scientific's Brad Sutton. He is the Chief Medical Officer of the AF Solutions Division. So we talked a lot about Farapulse and cardiac ablation. I learned a ton. He was a professor in a previous occupation, or he previously was a professor, and he's still got it. He's great at instructing and telling stories. So I know you'll enjoy that conversation. Before we begin, though, you'll hear from our great sponsor, Freudenberg Medical. Grateful to have them as part of our Device Talks family and as a sponsor of this particular episode. Managing Editor Kayleen Brown will lead that conversation. But of course, we'll kick this all off with the Newmarker's newsmakers. Mass Devices, Chris Newmarker, the big cheese, the head honcho, will roll out his top five stories from the pages, the electronic pages of Mass Device. Before we begin, this week, the week of January 20th, we'll be rolling out three digital discussions, three Device Talks Tuesdays. Only one of them takes place on Tuesday, so I'm saying digital discussions. We'll be talking surgical robotics with Steve Bell and Joe Mullings on January 21st. We'll be talking ASCs with Scott Fraser of Fraser Healthcare and Lionel Flexion of Distal Motion. He's the VP of R&D there. And then on Thursday, I get to connect with John Norris of HSBC to talk about his annual venture report. So you can go to devicetalks.com to find out more information about those presentations. They're all free. If you watch them live, you can ask your own questions. If you watch them on demand, you can enjoy the questions that others have asked. So it's a win-win either way, but we hope you'll join us. They take place at noon on the 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. Again, we'll go robotics, ASCs, fundraising. So go to devicetalks.com to find out more information about that. Finally, Device Talks Boston registration has been opened. We'll begin announcing speakers very soon, and you can still register using our early bird rate. Please go to boston.devicetalks.com, and we'll be opening up registration for Device Talks Minnesota very soon as well, and announcing speakers for that. That's taking place on June 11th at the McNamara Alumni Center. So excited to be back in Minnesota. All right, folks, now let's begin this episode of the Device Talks weekly podcast. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Chris Newmarker, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well. How you doing, man?
Doing well. This is our first pure newsmakers. We had Jim Hammerand on last week.
Yes.
But this is the first mano-y-mano Newmarker's newsmakers.
It's you and me, man.
Good to be back.
Good to be back. Good to be back.
Any snow out there on the grounds of Minnesota?
Oh, I got a little snow on the lawn, and we're gonna after today this weekend. It's in the 30s today. It's amazing, but it's heat wave. But this weekend we're getting the weather channels calling it a Siberian Express, which I mean anything that has Siberia as an adjective, I just don't like that. It doesn't really.
Or you don't want the las or the l's before a La Nina or an El Nino.
No.
Yeah,
I don't want that.
My son's obviously at Purdue, and he's reporting some cold temps on the plains of Indiana as well. So
I've heard it's going to get worse.
Hey, he could have gone to school in New England, but no, he wanted to go to Purdue. But anyway, all right.
It'll build character. It's good for him.
It will. Yeah, it will.
There you go. Oh, and just for the, I made sure today to wear my Ohio State National Championship shirt from 2002 on today.
Yeah, show the podcasters what you're wearing, the podcast audience what you're wearing.
Just trying to build the good luck for the big game coming up.
Wow. Is the game Monday?
Monday, yep.
All right. That's because usually it's been a very often, not always, but it's been on the Monday of JP Morgan. So I don't know, is it a week later this year? Like, I've gone to many JP Morgan events that had TVs up so people could watch the big game.
Playoffs got bigger this year, which is good, because I mean, in the past, like losing to Michigan, that would have been it. But hey, I'll take this. This is nice. I like 12 team college football playoff. This is good.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Well, again, going to Purdue college football is not a primary concern of ours. At least the playoff systems aren't.
they had a good football team a decade or so ago. Who knows? Maybe
they will rise again.
Maybe the Boilermakers will rise again.
They have a new coach. Got to turn this thing around. All right, Chris Neumacher.
There you go.
We got a busy morning here, so let's hop into
JP Morgan
week too. So lots of big news coming out of St. Francisco. So what is number five on this vaunted list?
So number five, we've got this was something that I saw you promoting on LinkedIn, Tom. But it's a Sean Hooley story,
mm-hmm.
and it's Abbott getting a win with Medicare for its cardio MEMS system,
MEMS,
which
I mean
cardio MEMS. Thank you. All right, I'm waiting for the coffee to kick in.
Cardio MEMS would be something you'd post on Instagram. Cardio MEMS is, I believe, something that Abbott is.
But not on TikTok, because it seems like it's going away. But anyway, I mean, you know, this is, this system has been around for a bit, an implantable, cardiac monitoring technology. But I remember kind of like the discussion that you got going on LinkedIn. This is like actually really exciting, because, you know, there's been a need for more reimbursement for this kind of like sophisticated health tracking mm-hmm. technology. So, I mean, just really cool to see, CMS stepping up and getting some more coverage going for
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Now, we've talked with Adana Medical. They're working on a version of this next generation. Of course, we've had Bill Hunter of Canary Medical on here, and we're all talking about the value of sensors and smart implants, but none of it happens unless there's payment for it. So this is certainly good news for the connected health industry. So great job by Abbott,
exactly.
Sort of blazing the trail. I'm sure they're working on generation twos internally at Abbott as well. So it's going to be an exciting decade.
I know we're talking on Friday morning, and Sean has another story out this morning about AliveCor mm-hmm. getting some win over at CMS. So yeah, like let's keep these coming. This sounds great.
Do you ever let Sean out of the house, or do you just have him chained to a desk where he's writing these articles?
No, Sean.
No sunlight for Sean.
I mean, Sean sometimes takes, I run the whole, mass device wire so he can, run out and interview somebody around Boston. So just for our listeners, Sean is in Boston.
Yes.
Invite Sean to come, check out your company, check out your technology.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's get Sean around Boston some more.
You could not have a more delightful guest than Sean Hooley. He is a gentleman and definitely a smart fellow.
Absolutely.
So yeah, invite him to your Boston MedTech.
He's a classy dude. Get him over to your place. So.
He is a classy dude. All right, let's roll on to number four on the Neumacher's Newsmakers.
All right. Hey, number four on the list, we've got, this is another Sean article. Just because, as Tom said, he's just sitting there with those chains on his legs, so he's got to, just keep on writing stuff.
More, Hooley! Write us more!
I'm like, no, I'm no way like that. If anything, it's usually more like Sean, it's enough stories a day, man. Take a break. It's all right.
You're going to break the internet, Sean. Stop writing.
You're going to break the internet. This is great. No, so, this was, Sean, Sean... checked out, Mike Mahoney's, the recordings of Mike Mahoney's, a presentation at JP Morgan, and had a great story about how, really the two things that, Mahoney says really driving growth at Boston Scientific is, the Fair Pulse, pulse field ablation system,
mm-hmm.
and, the Watchman, left atrial appendage closure device. And, these are both minimally invasive delivered therapies. Watchman, of course, is an implant, that, is going to, provide this LAA that can hopefully reduce the, you know, the chances of stroke, you know, for the people who get the implant. I mean, it's just, you know, amazing to see how much this has just grown Boston Scientific's, you know, business in this area. I mean, like, I mean, Mahoney was saying they used to be, you know, like a number four player in electrophysiology, and now they expect to be, you know, number two by the middle of this year. And, you know, and he's like saying, hey, we're going to be number one in coming years. And just today, actually, Sean has another story out, you know, that Boston Scientific, I mean, Sean has another story, right? So, but Sean,
Sean, I hope you're listening to this podcast, Sean.
I know, like Sean's ears are burning right now. I mean, you know, another story out today was like Boston Scientific released a bunch of new data about, you know, Farapulse and Watchman 2, like just some really good results. And with the Farapulse data, the analysts were saying that they thought this data would support a labeling expansion for Farapulse later this year. So just a lot of exciting news with EP. And talking about all that, I mean, you've got one of the top people there at Boston Scientific. Like, you're interviewing them for this podcast.
He's our guest today. Yeah, we didn't time it this way. But yeah, and I posted just a quote of his from the conversation because I saw Sean's article. I'm like, well, wait a minute. I think I have something tied to this. And yeah, Brad Sutton, he's the chief medical officer of Boston Scientific's EP and Watchman business. Great guy. Fascinating. Yeah. Great podcast voice. I told him on LinkedIn, if you want to give up a life-saving, rewarding career in med tech, he has a future as a podcaster, but I don't think he'll take us up on the offer. But he said, if I think back to a few years ago when I joined the company 5.5 years ago, Boston Scientific EP was a pretty fledgling, often forgotten about division, but now it's on pace to be the biggest division of Boston Scientific if this trajectory continues. And I'm not sure that there's a better story in medtech than the growth of that franchise, really largely on the back of the Farapulse product. So,
yeah,
amazing story. Yeah, no, yeah, good for Boston.
So much excitement around pulse field ablation. I mean, that this is just like a new ablation technology but they, you know, they got it to the point that you could actually like use pulse field to treat AFib, and you know, that it could, you know, like treat it without, you know, some of the side effects that they've seen with like RF ablation, because it'll, you know, damage the cardiac tissue without like you know, while the tissue around it is less susceptible. So I mean this is good news for the patients, you know, and you know, great to see Boston Scientific seeing some success off of helping people like this.
And I've talked to a lot of people about pulse field ablation. Obviously, we both have. Brad, actually, I never really thought, or at least I don't recall, the issue. Part of the issue being the esophagus, that burning the esophagus is something they're really mindful of. And I don't know. I just when I think of these things, I'm thinking about, oh, the heart is like just this thing that they're dealing, but it's packed in your chest with all those other vital organs and tissues around here. Technology like this is game changing, and it's I think it's going to make things more productive and people live longer, healthier lives. So this is why we love MedTech, Chris Neumarker.
I thought it was interesting. One time, managing editor Jim Hammerand over at MDO, he was interviewing somebody at Medtronic about renal denervation, and he was like, "Hey, why didn't you use pulse field for renal denervation?" And they were like, "Well, because it's not as the nerve tissue isn't as susceptible to it." So I mean, that's why we use RF. But it's kind of like the pulse field, that's good. The cardiac tissue is susceptible to it, it's the way to go. So
yeah. All right. Well, let's roll on to number three, Chris Neumarker.
Hey, number three on the list. You know, guess who wrote this? So this is another Sean story. This is also from JPM, or actually it's just more like we had tons of companies releasing like preliminary results this week, like around you know, around that conference. And like Intuitive was saying, I liked how on LinkedIn, I mean, you've been on a tear on LinkedIn, Tom. I mean, you were saying that you were noting from this report that the new Da Vinci 5 system, if you think of it this way, 362 of them placed last year. I mean, they're 365 days in a year. I mean, they're replacing this new robot. They're replacing one a day.
And as I amended, they didn't get approval until in mid-March. So they really just had three quarters to do it, if that, maybe half. So. Yeah. And I know I talked with Steve Bell, who will be on a webinar with Joe Mullings and me on Tuesday. January 21st, looking at surgical robotics where it's headed. And we were talking offline, and I believe, and Steve, forgive me if I got the numbers wrong, but I think he was projecting like they would maybe sell 200, and people were giving him guff about that, about they'll never hit 200. So Intuitive is on a roll, man.
Yeah.
I mean, this, you know, competition is great, and we welcome all comers, but it's hard to deny Intuitive's getting the job done.
This newest generation system up the game. I mean, procedures increasing 17% last year. So, I mean, they're just on a roll on there. And you know, as Joe's kind of said, it's widened the moat. I mean, for companies like Medtronic and J&J that, you know, really want to, you know, that have their, you know, soft tissue systems that want to get in the space. But, I mean, it said something that on MDO, Jim had an article you know, like the Medtronic, you know, CEO Jeff Martha talking about all the innovations they're excited about. And he mentioned robotic surgery, but he, like Martha said at JPM that, I mean, they were really driving hard to be a strong number two in the space.
Hmm. Interesting.
I mean, that's how much that success and Intuitive has affected things that, like, I mean, Medtronic's going to be high-fiving themselves being a number two, like.
I think anything else, people would be looking at him sideways at this point. So I think that's a very reasonable statement
totally.
To make for sure.
So,
all right. So folks can register for that webinar at devicetalks.com.
I'm going to be listening.
I mentioned this at the top. It's already our record breaker. We have we broke our record for registration. So
that's
starting
fantastic.
Off 2025, right.
Let's
roll into number two.
Must-see webinar. Yeah, let's keep going. Sorry about that, Tom. Number two on the list, also by Sean. We've got Medtronic getting a
I didn't know that. When I said Sean, I didn't realize he wrote all of these. Okay, good. Continue.
Actually, yes. Let's just assume everything here is written by Sean this week. I did write things this week, but like Sean.
I know you did.
Sean's just got the good stuff. It's pretty great. Number two on the list, we've got like Medtronic getting a CE mark for their adaptive deep brain stimulation tech for Parkinson's. I know we had a Medtronic official on last week talking about everything they've been doing around their brain, you know, their Percept PC neurostimulator and this brain sense technology that now has the CE mark. They're seeking to get a US nod for it as well. I mean, this is like, you know, adaptive, you know, deep brain stimulation to treat Parkinson's, like record and analyze his brain signals so they can like tailor the therapy. And there's just like a lot of, you know, excitement at Medtronic about what this technology is going to be able to do. So like it's going to be great to see what it does next.
That's fantastic. Yeah, no, and it's such an important space. And those videos are always amazing when you can see the impact that this technology has on someone who is just trying to get through their day and they can't. So really important thing. So good news from Medtronic.
You see these videos and they could just activate something and all of a sudden the tremors stop. I mean, it's just like life changing. So it's going to be really cool to keep on following that. And then number one on the list, I mean, it was a bit of a surprise for me, but it got a lot of looks on Mass Device, you know, and this was that, you know, Medtronic was, you know, like had an exclusive U.S. distribution agreement with Contigo Medical, you know, which has like this, you know, portfolio of, you know, products for, you know, revascularization of the carotid and peripheral, you know, carotid and peripheral vascular disease. And this includes like their FDA approved a NeuroGuard IEP 3-in-1 carotid stenting system. But the thing that was really, you know, this distribution deal included an option to buy. And I think, you know, we just haven't seen as much M&A from Medtronic. So I think there's just like kind of like a lot of, I think this got a lot of interest because people are like, oh, wow, this is a company that's got, you know, some tech that, I mean, it seems like our audience, you know, considers this technology very important. And, you know, and, you know, this is something that looks like, you know, Medtronic could be acquiring this.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, and I actually kind of glanced over the option to buy part, but that is an important part. And I don't know exactly where this falls into space. I mean, I don't know if people see this as sort of an Inari answer or something. I mean, it's a different sort of technology, but maybe the peripheral space is just really catching people's eyes. Because you're right, distribution deals don't normally draw a lot of eyeballs, but I guess when Medtronic does it, and suggest they may acquire the company.
And saying they're increasing their investment, they could acquire it. Yeah, I think that's what I think that's what did it. And definitely, like Medtronic, there's a Medtronic official in the news release was saying this was complementing their peripheral and stroke protection portfolio. So there you go. That's devices for to help protect people from stroke. That's been a really big space in our industry as well. So yeah, this will be another good one to watch.
Yep, and we saw those types of deals like Boston Scientific and Bolt Medical. I mean, they take these stakes and then they make a big acquisition of it later on to make a splash. So we'll certainly anticipate seeing more of that.
Totally. And I'd also just one more quick time, like give a plug to Jim's story on MDO, from Jeff Martha's JPM presentation. I mean, the fact that he singled out an innovation that he said could be the biggest thing we ever do, which, I mean, Medtronic's done a lot of really just big, innovative, amazing things over the decades. So, go check out Jim's article and see what Jeff Martha thinks is going to be the biggest thing they ever do over there.
It rhymes with... No, I won't ruin it. No, it's we certainly have talked.
I don't have enough coffee, Tom. I can't figure out how to rhyme with that one.
It'll end up sounding bad. So, Christian Marker.
All right.
Great take stuff it easy, as always. Man. Now we'll take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, Freudenberg Medical. We've got an interview conducted by my great colleague, Device Talks, Managing Editor Kayleen Brown.
Seamus McGuire, VP Growth and Lean Systems for Freudenberg Medical. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Kayleen. Great to be here. Thanks.
I know our audience knows how much we love Freudenberg Medical, but for those who don't know, can you please give us a 40,000-foot level of who Freudenberg Medical is?
Sure. Freudenberg Medical is a global partner to medical device OEMs for product design, development, and manufacturing. From medical components and tubing to drug device solutions and finished devices. Overall, we have 11 locations worldwide and are all based in key med tech clusters.
Freudenberg Medical definitely has a global presence. Can you tell us about you and your role?
Absolutely. In my role, I'm responsible for lean initiatives across Freudenberg Medical. I focus on how we can enhance operational efficiencies through various methodologies and excellence frameworks, so that the company is positioned as a leader in medical device manufacturing.
I know that Freudenberg Medical has deep experience as a design and manufacturing partner for electrophysiology, catheters, and solutions. Can you share some of those experiences?
Sure. Freudenberg Medical has been a trusted partner to medical device companies in electrophysiology for over 15 years. Our design and manufacturing collaborations cover a wide range of solutions, including steerable access devices, ablation catheters, and visualization technologies. And collectively, our EP customers serve over 60% of the global electrophysiology catheter market.
We're going to hear more from our sponsor, Freudenberg Medical, a little later on in the podcast, so stay tuned. But if you want to learn more now, please visit ep.freudenbergmedical.com. That's ep.freudenbergmedical.com. And now we're going to kick off our interview with Brad Sutton, VP Clinical Strategy and AF Solutions at Boston Scientific.
Well, Brad Sutton, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
Well, we love talking about pulse field ablation, about the treatments for atrial fibrillation. It's such a hot space, and I want to get I'm looking forward to the update on where Boston Scientific is headed. But also wanted to get a bit of your history and how you found yourself in the medical device industry. Obviously, you're a doctor, so I'm guessing the MD was the first part of that. So what brought you into, what led you to a career in medicine?
Gosh, depends on how far back you want to go, but I'm going to
wind us all the way back. Let's go.
All the way back.
6-year-old Brad Sutton with a little toy stethoscope in your ear. If that's what it was, let's start there.
It wasn't that. I was I was not one of these kids that always wanted to be a doctor. In fact, I'm the first person in my family to go to college, and it didn't seem possible for a long time. And I was blessed to have good mentors, and opportunities in my life. And in fact, my first love in medicine was international health. So I started, maybe the story really starts in college. I went to a very tiny college, Eureka College, alma mater of Ronald Reagan. And was in fact a Ronald Reagan fellow, which was an endowment that he created, his family created to provide scholarships and mentorships for students. So it was full tuition scholarship, and then you could choose two mentorships anywhere in the world you wanted to go. And I spent my first mentorship summer between sophomore and junior year doing missionary work in Zimbabwe, wow. volunteering at an orphanage and a medical mission. And that really was it. That solidified my interest and my passion for healthcare. And I was fully expecting to be, you know, traveling the world doing international healthcare development for the rest of my career.
What happened?
But as fate would have it, fell in love with cardiology and ultimately really, again, had great mentorship, did a research fellowship in cardiology as a medical student as part of what's called the Sarnoff Fellowship, again, endowed by Stan Sarnoff. And then was really lucky to have trained at Johns Hopkins from medical school all the way through my residency fellowship and, in fact, business school. And that became a career in academic electrophysiology and really one focused on the intersection of business and medicine very purposefully. And that was really my introduction to industry. So developed some really good relationships in industry as kind of the EP that liked the sausage making of healthcare economics.
What is it about cardiology that you found appealing? I have to think just the heart itself is such a piece of magic. I think it just must be really, I guess, absorbing.
It is. I think it's well said. It's fundamentally... it's a palpable physiology. Mm-hmm. So you can connect in a way at the patient's bedside with your hands on in a really organic way. And then electrophysiology is this beautiful intersection of using your hands and using your brain in what I think is one of the most complicated fields in medicine, trying to uncover mechanisms and treatment strategies for arrhythmias. Some of which are nuisances and some of which are really life-threatening. And and so, again, it was a privilege to be a part of that care continuum for many years in practice. And now, you know, trying my best to contribute on a broader scale, you know, on the hundreds of thousands of patients kind of scale as part of Boston Scientific.
Did you ever see yourself remaining? Well, first of all, do you still practice at all? Do you still treat patients?
I don't. No, I transitioned to full time with the company in 2019.
Did you see a crossroads where you're like, I'm either going to be a leading physician in this space, an interventionalist in this space, or I'm going to go to industry? Or was it always clear that you were, again, after interested in where the sausages were being made and that was the path you were always going to take?
Yeah, the crossroads for me was, you know, even when I was in practice, I was doing the full spectrum of clinical EP, but really with about half of my time. And then the other half of my time was in this, what I thought was a really fun, creative space focused on, again, that intersection of business and medicine. So how do you teach the next generation of physicians about healthcare economics and reimbursement and that whole landscape, which isn't fundamentally part of our medical education? I taught in the business school at the University of Louisville for a number of years and focused on health strategy. And so how do you help physicians anticipate reimbursement landscape changes and articulate the value of a certain service line or program they want to develop and to develop a pro forma around that and really make the business case for clinical growth?
Wow. Okay. I didn't think that physicians were learning these subjects to that degree in an academic setting. I thought it was something that you learned once you sort of rolled out there and you just kind of took your knocks and learned your lessons.
Unfortunately, some people never learn it, and we set up to change that in some small ways. But it, you know, for me, the crossroads then was a kind of an academic or maybe an increasingly an enterprise kind of level administrative role. I looked at some hospital CMO jobs or industry, and an opportunity came up at Boston Scientific that turned out to be a really good place to land.
Very cool. So let's talk about the problem, atrial fibrillation. If you could give us just a 90-second sort of overview, or go longer if you want. What is it? What are the risks? You mentioned there's variations of whether it could be a nuisance or something far more life-threatening. What's the difference between the two?
Yeah, atrial fibrillation is the most common arrhythmia in the world. You know, the incidence of AFib goes up significantly as we get older, and we have generally a sicker patient population out there. And I used to tell my patients there's really two reasons we care about AFib. One is that it can make you feel poorly, either because your heart's racing or it's irregular or cause shortness of breath. There's a whole host of symptoms that can come along with atrial fibrillation. And there are tried and true therapies to reduce that symptom burden, namely cardiac ablation. And then the second reason we care is because when your heart's in atrial fibrillation, think of it like electrical chaos in the top chambers of the heart. You don't get effective contraction of blood into the bottom chambers of the heart. And so that stasis of blood, that pooling of blood in the top chamber, can cause clots, and those clots can embolize and cause trouble. The most worrisome of which is a cardioembolic stroke. And so that little vestigial pouch off the left atrium called the appendage is where most of those clots form. That really is the basis for our left atrial appendage closure business, the Watchman business, as a stroke prevention strategy. And what we, I'm sure we'll get into, is how we try to think about tackling all of the above. And I think as a company, I've thought about that whole continuum of care of the AFib patient, from kind of diagnostics to ablation to get you feeling better, and then preventing stroke with appendage closure in the right patients, is, I think, a really nice story to tell kind of across the continuum of care, if you will.
So what are the three primary, or the primary, I mean, maybe more than three or less than, fewer than three, but what are the primary ways of treating atrial fibrillation? We'll obviously get into pulse field ablation in a moment and exactly what that means, but what are the options for patients and for physicians?
So with regards to sort of symptom benefit and trying to get you feeling better, ablation really is the mainstay. And, you know, there have been, throughout kind of the history of the field, many studies that show ablation is superior to medications, antiarrhythmic medications. And historically, we've had two options for ablation. One is the cryo energy, the other is radiofrequency energy, both of which are considered thermal ablation modalities. And they basically target areas that we know are troublesome and cause and sustain atrial fibrillation, and allow us to create essentially scar in strategic areas, namely around the pulmonary veins that enter into the left atrium, and electrically isolate those pulmonary veins from the rest of the atrium. And that effectively eliminates or reduces the risk of recurrence of atrial fibrillation in many, many patients. The problem with that has been thermal ablation is a relatively indiscriminate way of tackling cardiac tissue. And in fact, heating or cooling, depending on which of those modalities you choose, can have collateral damage to the areas around the heart tissue that you're intending to ablate. And the things that you worry most about are damage to the esophagus, and what it turns out to be a very high risk of mortality, the dreaded esophageal fistula.
Oh, wow.
But even damage to phrenic nerve, you know, sort of nerves that surround the heart can get damaged. And so that's,
is there a point where the esophagus runs that? I guess when I thought about collateral damage, it was going to be other, you know, surrounding heart tissue that was healthy that you didn't want to ablate. But there are other parts of the body that are of concern as well. I had no idea.
Anatomically, if you looked, you know, if you looked at a CAT scan, for example, and you looked at the posterior wall of the left atrium, it abuts directly the esophagus. So those two are within millimeters of one another. And so if you've got kind of a radiation of heat or cold from that area, it can really, we monitor the esophageal temperature very closely to minimize the risk of damage there.
Yeesh. Okay. No, that's, but it, that would be in cases where the tissue that needs to be ablated is in that precise part of the heart, or I guess I've never really asked this question. Is the place you bladed, is it always the same place, or does it depend upon each individual's disease or condition?
Oh, man, that's a great question, and it's a very complex answer. I'll try to keep simple. The mainstay of ablation is pulmonary vein isolation. So typical pulmonary vein anatomy would be, you know, two on the left, two on the right, inserting into the posterior aspect of the left atrium. And you essentially electrically isolate each of those veins. Now, that's what we typically do for any patient in their first procedure. What can be done beyond that is perhaps less evidence-based, although we're trying to put some evidence around that, and more kind of art than science in many cases. And I think the sicker the patient, the longer lived the atrial fibrillation. You know, you think about persistent and long-standing persistent patients, we very often try to tailor the therapy beyond pulmonary vein isolation to that individual patient, depending on what the health of their overall left atrium looks like. Wow. And that can include any number of things that, you know, that might be posterior wall ablation or ablation of atypical left atrial tachycardias or flutters in various places in the left heart and even in the right heart. And so that gets to be, it's maybe beyond the topic of conversation today, but it gets to kind of our go forward clinical strategy and how do we tackle complex patients that need something beyond PVI, kind of a hot topic of debate in the field.
Interesting.
We'll take a quick break from our interview with Boston Scientific's Brad Sutton to bring back Seamus McGuire, VP of Growth and Lean Systems for Freudenberg Medical. Okay, Seamus, so I'm going to put you on the spot here. If you had to choose just one impact that you're especially proud of, what would that be?
You know, we're especially proud of the impact our solutions have in the field. For example, one in every four ablation procedures is supported by a Freudenberg Medical solution. And we estimate that every 2 minutes, an AFib patient is treated with a device we manufacture on behalf of our customers.
That's incredible. So I'm trying to really understand the problem that's trying to be solved here. As we look at the entire electrophysiology market, what is the problem that Freudenberg Medical is trying to help solve?
You know, the global burden of AFib is staggering, with clinical studies estimating 33 to 59 million patients worldwide, and that figure is expected to double in the next 20 to 30 years. So despite the proven effectiveness of catheter ablation, fewer than 5% of patients currently receive this impactful therapy. And at Freudenberg Medical, we see improving patient outcomes for AFib as a shared responsibility across the entire medtech sector, whether you're a clinician, an OEM, CDMO, or other stakeholder. Our vision is to partner with our customers to double the number of AFib patients treated with interventional therapies by the end of this decade.
So that really helps me understand, you know, how the EP market is set for exponential growth. What is Freudenberg Medical doing to ensure that you're not just keeping pace, but you're leading as a CDMO partner?
Mm-hmm. Well, our vision, it really informs what we do. And right now we're busy addressing two critical industry challenges where we can make an impact: capacity and capability. Simply put, the collective industry must double EP catheter production within the next 4 to 5 years. Freudenberg Medical is preparing to meet this challenge with significant investments and innovative approaches to scaling. For example, we've invested $25 million in a second facility in Costa Rica dedicated to assembling high-volume catheters, including EP catheters. Additionally, we're leveraging cutting-edge smart technologies such as virtual or augmented reality and AI in manufacturing, an area where we believe we're uniquely positioned as a CDMO.
Okay, I have to stop you there, Seamus. You just said virtual reality and artificial intelligence when talking about EP catheter manufacturing. So I'm literally the host of our Device Talks AI podcast, so I have to know more. Please tell me more.
Absolutely. VR and AI are helping us bring products to market faster and with higher quality. You know, we started with VR training and the results were incredible. Training time dropped by 75%, scrap rates fell by 50%, and all without interrupting production. VR training helps to standardize the human elements and build muscle memory for operators, and that's critical for manufacturing skills associated with highly complex EP catheters. From there, we expanded our VR usage to optimize processes like our 3P layout preparation, replacing physical mock-up of lines with immersive digital walkthroughs of the lines. And the great thing about this is the collaboration you can achieve with VR. For example, when we're transferring lines between our sites, we can train operators on production lines or walk engineers through virtual lines without physically relocating team members between the incoming and the outgoing sites. You know, and this is also true for our customers. I mean, they can walk through their new line before it even exists. So that's awesome for our customers. And you mentioned AI, your interest in AI. You know, AI is actually taking us to the next level. We developed a proprietary AI model trained on lean tools, and it can analyze over 36,000 potential cell layouts in minutes. The best designs are then automatically fed into our VR headsets, letting us walk through the experience of these optimized layouts. In fact, this is how we're planning our new greenfield facility layouts.
Wow, I love everything to do with artificial intelligence and VR, and this will no doubt make a huge impact on your customers.
Absolutely. I mean, when you consider the combined potential of VR and AI, it really offers a fresh perspective on the longstanding manufacturing challenge of how to scale up quickly and efficiently. VR and AI are just some of the ways in which we're trying to push the boundaries.
I love that, Seamus. Okay, Seamus McGuire, VP of Growth and Lead Systems for Freudenberg Medical. Thank you for indulging me and for sharing Freudenberg Medical's journey.
You're welcome, Kayleen. Thanks very much for having me on the podcast today.
What a way to kick off the year. Thank you again to Freudenberg Medical for sponsoring this episode of Device Talks Weekly. To discuss a partnership with Freudenberg Medical for your EP catheter portfolio, visit their dedicated EP website, which is www.ep.freudenbergmedical.com. And now the conclusion of our interview with Brad Sutton, Vice President, Clinical Strategy and AF Solutions at Boston Scientific.
So, yeah, well, let's talk about where we're moving. And I'm sorry if to take us off target, but the newer, I guess I'm surprised. I guess I've always thought that the treatment, the ablation of the ablation of the heart, it's always treated as something that will just be going to be done. Like you're getting your car fixed. Like it's not that complex. I hadn't realized that there were so many variables to it and so many things that could go wrong. Let's talk a bit about the advances in treatment. So pulse field ablation. What is pulse field ablation offering that other forms of treatment are not able to?
Yeah, so pulse field ablation we sometimes refer synonymously to as electroporation or irreversible mm-hmm. electroporation is really an old field that has had a resurgence for cardiac ablation. But this field's been around for many years in various ways. Cancer therapies, for example, gene therapies. And it is fundamentally applying a high energy electrical field to an area of interest, in this case, the atrial myocardium. And what we're trying to do is create cell death through a fundamentally different mechanism than heating or cooling. So it's opening up small channels or pores in the cell membranes, causing cell death. Mm-hmm. And it's doing so in a relatively tissue-selective way. And so there are many, many things that get dialed in to create a pulse field ablation waveform. And each catheter and each company has their own sort of secret sauce, if you will. But what we're all trying to do is to target the atrial myocardium and only the atrial myocardium where we intend to cause that irreversible electroporation and cell death mm-hmm. and therefore avoid the collateral damage risk.
So how are you able to get that precise, and how many catheters are used in a procedure? How are you able to get the visualization you need or the visibility you need? I'm not sure what the right term is to make sure you're hitting the right spot.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things in that question. I think of it fundamentally like a three-legged stool. So you have the waveform of your particular PFA offering, and each company is different. That waveform has to be tuned specifically to not just the atrial myocardial use case, but the catheter form factor. So each catheter will have its own shape and functionality and electrode configuration, and you have to optimize both of those things in concert to get the desired result. And what you're trying to do is to not create heat, to mitigate or eliminate the risk of thermal injury, but create effective tissue selective ablation. And it's easier said than done. The final piece to that three-legged stool is the dosing strategy. So how many applications, how long do those applications take? You know, what is the energy level in the generator that you're delivering? And how do you sort of move and rotate in the given anatomy you want to ablate? And we were fortunate in that we essentially acquired Farapulse, who had a decade or longer sort of track record of iterating on this with what ultimately became the FARAWAVE catheter. Mm-hmm. And so that waveform, that catheter form factor, and that dosing strategy that is commercially used today was 10 years, you know, plus in the making. And it's why we have such a head start in the field. It's why I would say our competitors have really struggled to catch up, is that there's no sort of shortcut to that. And again, every time we change the use case and we move beyond the atrium, or we think about a different catheter form factor, that process of marrying up all of those three legs of the stool sort of starts again.
So one term I want to understand a bit better is mapping. I hear the term mapping with these procedures. What exactly does that mean, and what kind of technology is used in that?
Yeah. So if I think about the Farapulse journey, we had CE mark, you know, several years ahead of our U.S. commercialization, and this was without a mapping system fully integrated. And so I think of mapping in an ablation case the same way I think about using kind of a navigation system in your car when you're trying to get somewhere. It is a way to visualize, really in three dimensions, the anatomy of the heart, the catheters that you're trying to navigate within that anatomy, and then tracking and tagging where have we delivered therapy. And so you can measure things and kind of define things such as what is the scar in the left atrium? Where does it live, and how severe is it in different parts of the left atrium, or any chamber of the heart for that matter? And that may inform your ablation strategy. Certainly you can sort of delineate where are the pulmonary veins and make sure that you've adequately covered circumferentially the pulmonary vein anatomy when you're doing your ablation. So it really goes hand in hand with kind of navigating and tracking the therapy.
Mm-hmm.
The beautiful thing about Farapulse is that you can do this procedure with or without mapping. And there's a number of different ways to kind of visualize the catheter and the therapy without mapping. You can use, obviously, fluoroscopy or x-ray with or without the combination of intracardiac ultrasound. And our first couple of years and all of our real-world evidence from Europe was done without a fully integrated mapping system. And in the majority of those cases in Europe, they were done without any mapping system. So it's not required, but in the U.S., the vast, vast majority of AFib ablations are done with mapping. Mm-hmm. And we were delighted earlier this year to get FDA approval and clearance for both our FARAWAVE NAV-enabled catheter and our FARAVIEW mapping software that work in concert to help visualize both the anatomy, the catheter as we're moving the catheter within that anatomy, and then tracking the lesions with field tags that sort of say, where have I ablated and where have I yet to ablate?
Does the mapping level the playing field for more physicians to be able to perform more of these procedures in a better fashion? Or does it shorten these procedures? What's the benefit of the mapping? And I'm hoping clinical outcome is part of it as well. But what does mapping allow the industry to do?
I think that's a story that we're still writing. And so we may well see benefit clinically to mapping versus not mapping. I think the reason to be hopeful in that regard is that it'll allow you to track where you've ablated and make sure you're not leaving any gaps. We've got great clinical data that say our outcomes are as good. We have a prospective randomized trial, frankly, called ADVENT, which was run head-to-head against thermal ablation, which shows equivalent outcomes in terms of efficacy without mapping. Mm-hmm. But that said, there may be reason to believe mapping has incremental benefit. The other thing that I think mapping could help us solve is that, you know, this technology is very efficient. It's very easy to use. And if you're not careful, you can do more than you need to. And mm-hmm. so the goal with ablation should always be to do enough to get the clinical outcome desired, but really no more than you need. And so tracking your lesions with the mapping system will allow you to avoid overlapping and repeating lesions in a given area, and actually may have some benefit from a safety standpoint as well.
But how do you know you did what you need to do? Is it just because you've mapped things out so well and you know the precise spots you have to hit? There's no way to monitor the patient or measure the patient and say, okay, the heart is performing as it should. We did what we need to do. Now let's pull out.
Yeah, that's a great question. The field of electrophysiology is really elegant, and there are certain arrhythmias where you can do functional testing to prove that you've done what you intended to do and that you've cured the arrhythmia. Atrial fibrillation is a bit harder to do that with. And with pulse field ablation, and this is true for every PFA system out there, it's such a high output electrical field that it does cause a lot of sort of electrical silencing even after the first application. Mm-hmm. So traditional metrics of testing, provocatively testing through what we call EP testing, essentially, and EP maneuvers to verify arrhythmia elimination and minimize the chance of recurrence is tough to do with PFA. That said, again, the mainstay is actually pretty empiric and anatomically driven. And so you can very easily get a sense with or without mapping, but I think mapping it helps to some degree. Have I adequately isolated the pulmonary veins circumferentially? And then if your intent is to do more than that, let's say posterior wall ablation, for example, you can track those lesions that you do on the FARAVIEW mapping software very, very elegantly, and make sure that you've adequately covered the whole anatomy that you hope to ablate.
Wow, that's fascinating. So what has the response been from the community at large, patients, physicians, hospital systems, in regard to FARAVIEW, and what kind of impact have you seen?
So we did an initial FARAVIEW limited market release. I think the feedback's been amazing. We've run some kind of national educational programs recently and had some recorded and live cases on podium with excellent feedback. You know, if I think back just a few years ago when I joined the company, now 5.5 years ago, Boston Scientific EP was a pretty fledgling, often forgotten about division. It's on pace to be the biggest division at Boston Scientific if this trajectory continues. And I'm not sure there's a better story in medtech than the growth of that franchise, really largely on the back of the FARAPULSE product.
It's really exciting to be part of something like that. And you've had some other acquisitions as well, right? The CoreTech acquisition, what does that do, and how does that build out the platform and the portfolio?
Yeah, that was a fun acquisition. So I had a chance to be a part of that diligence effort. And you know, I think largely we think about atrial fibrillation as kind of two buckets as we segment the market. They're not perfectly mutually exclusive, but you have the sort of paroxysmal AFib patient who has AFib and symptoms that come and go. They tend to get a pulmonary vein isolation only strategy as a first procedure, pretty straightforward procedure with really good clinical predictable outcomes. And then you have this bucket of patients who have more advanced disease and persistent atrial fibrillation. So it's always there. And, you know, there's this old saying in the field that AFib begets AFib, and that the more you're in it, the longer your heart is exposed to that rhythm, the sort of more negative remodeling and detrimental evolution of that disease process. And so we very often want to do more with the persistent AFib patients. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that more is empiric and anatomically driven. And I can tell you in our ADVANTAGE trial, which was our trial to pursue a persistent AF label. That data will be on podium, you know, in the next few weeks at the AF symposium. That was an empiric PVI and posterior wall ablation strategy in everybody. There are other patients who will still need more, and the what more to do is a very open question. So where Cortex comes into the portfolio is as a complement to our persistent AF ablation strategy. And what it's meant to do is through artificial intelligence, using a large 64-pole catheter, is map both the right and left heart in a very sophisticated way that helps identify sources beyond pulmonary veins that we could target to hopefully improve the efficacy for those persistent AF patients that need more done.
How is the clinical community responded to all of these new tools? If your division has grown this much over 5 years, I'm guessing that's reflected outside in terms of the whole practice, the whole EP practice and the EP clinical field.
Yeah, I would say that there's a lot of credibility when people get the FARAPULSE product in their hand and they sort of implement it in their system. And this really resonates with healthcare administrators as well. It's easy to use. It's reproducible. The workflow is quite good. And you're able to do more in a given amount of time. So that efficiency story plays. And then the sort of what's next and what do you have up next for me is kind of maybe the next conversation. As far as how Cortex will be received, I think there's skepticism in the field. We've seen many companies come and go with kind of the value proposition of we're going to do better for persistent AF. And by and large, they haven't succeeded. We feel that we have a differentiated opportunity here just based on the way the technology works and has evolved. But we have to prove it out. And so obviously we saw enough that we made the acquisition, enough that we liked that we made the acquisition. But it's incumbent upon us now to run a rigorous trial to prove out the clinical benefit and hopefully then gain broad adoption that ultimately helps more patients.
Final couple of questions. What is the number of physicians in this space look like in terms of, is this an area where we're seeing fewer folks go into this field? Is it growing? Is it an area of increased popularity because there are new tools to use? What's the size of the clinical market look like in terms of number of physicians who are performing this? Because if there are fewer, there's an opportunity for you to make it easier and to make more people be able to do it, enable physicians to do it faster. But what does the field look like? Kind of answering my question for you, and I should just shut up.
I don't know if I know all of those answers off the top of my head. I can tell you that, you know, I helped run a EP fellowship program for a number of years. And certainly the demand and the enthusiasm for any subspecialty, you know, kind of waxes and wanes over time. There's never been a more exciting time to dive into electrophysiology than there is right now. From the company standpoint, there's never been a better time to be an EP than where we are today. My sense is certainly the market opportunity is enormous. It's absolutely enormous. And the growth, you know, is well into the double digits. I mean, we could probably fact check this by somebody smarter than me, but, you know, we've got a market opportunity that's growing, you know, 20%+ per year is my guess. And so I suspect it's one of those fields where the technologies we're seeing come to light enable better outcomes, and that's really satisfying as a clinician. And my guess is that you're going to see more people clamoring to do EP. Shorter procedure times also are very attractive. Yeah. That's one of the things that's historically hampered the field is that, you know, when I started, we did AFib ablations, and when we went from one to two, and then ideally three a day, we thought we were really doing something.
Wow.
And now people are doing, you know, two, three times that in a given lab in a given day. And so it's come a long way.
That's amazing. Ed, you had referenced the excitement about the future. Last question, what is the past 5 years, you've seen a lot of change. What are you able to tell us about what you like to see over the next 5 years?
Well, this is, you're probably tired of people talking about AI, but I think it's, I think in as much as it applies to EP, using smart applications for artificial intelligence to predict successful sites of ablation or successful strategies and help us better understand arrhythmia mechanism has to be the next frontier. I think the technology is there. We just have to put the pieces together in a smart way that helps us inform how we do complex ablations so that, again, we're doing only as much as we need and we're not doing any harm along the way.
Fantastic. Well, this has been a very informative and enjoyable conversation, Brad Sutton. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. My pleasure.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much to Freudenberg Medical for sponsoring this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Thanks to you for being part of it. Please share this episode on LinkedIn. When you do, connect with me and my colleagues, Chris Newmarker of Mass Device and Kayleen Brown of Device Talks. Of course, we'd love you to share this episode on social media and tag us when you do so we can be part of those conversations. And make sure you're a subscriber or a follower to the Device Talks Podcast Network. It's where you're going to get all the great future podcasts that we're putting out. We've got a lot coming out in 2025. It's going to be a great year for MedTech podcasts. Reminder, if you haven't yet registered for our upcoming Device Talks Tuesdays series, you can still do that at devicetalks.com. We'll be talking about surgical robotics and about ASCs and about the year for financing. So you can check out the details of those presentations, which are free. You can watch on demand or live. Go to devicetalks.com and look for the Device Talks Tuesday tag. And you can, again, find all that information there. Also, Device Talks Boston will be rolling out the agenda very shortly. You can still register using our early bird rate. Go to boston.devicetalks.com. I'll start announcing our speakers on the website. Of course, they'll go up there, but I'll begin posting them on LinkedIn as well. And it's going to be a fantastic couple of days. I'm very excited about the conversations we'll be having, so don't miss that. And we'll be opening up registration for Device Talks Minnesota as well, rolling beginning to secure speakers for that as well at the McNamara Alumni Center. So we're rolling with our events, and we hope you'll join us at Device Talks Boston and Device Talks Minnesota. All right, folks, thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast.